diagram or Minkowski space. Interesting events like collisions or receiving a signal were points on this line, but we also want to talk about physicists moving through the space-time, and they would travel along some world line. And a simple way, or a conventional way that we're used to in, say, classical mechanics to describe that world line would be describing the trajectory by specifying the position as a function of time. So this is our standard classical description. But then time, well, as it does in classical mechanics, time is playing a special role compared to the spatial coordinates. And so it breaks the democracy between time and space, or the x, y, and z. And so it's much more natural to describe the points in the space-time as a function of some other parameter. So we would have x alpha, all four of the components of the position. So alpha runs over 0 as well as 1, 2, 3 as a function of some auxiliary parameter. A question is, what parameters can we choose? Well, in fact, we can choose any parameter to describe a line like this. But a natural choice is to choose the value, if the observer or the object carries a clock, a natural choice for that parameter is to choose the time associated with that clock, or what's known as the proper time associated with this observer. The time measured by a clock. So implicitly, I'm assuming this is a time-like trajectory, i.e. the tangent vector is time-like everywhere. That means that infinitesimal displacements everywhere are time-like displacements. And so what I call, if I'm thinking about small displacements or infinitesimal displacements along that line, those displacements can be referred to this time of the clock, or minus c squared d tau squared. What I said is, any given a displacement like that, a time-like displacement, I can always find a frame where it's just a d tau. So it's the d tau of the clock moving in that direction. But I can think that this is then referring to this frame, or this fixed frame. It's just given by the minus c t squared dx squared along that small segment of the world line. So if I had a particle that was moving with a constant velocity like this, I could write, or I could relate the dt and the d tau, so I'd have c dt equals c d tau square root of minus b squared over c squared. So this reflects the time dilation that we talked about before. I can also relate the dx's, given that there's a fixed velocity, to the d tau's. But in general, then, so this is a very special kind of trajectory. It's the trajectory of an inertial observer. In general, we want to, or we might want to think about more interesting trajectories. I may go to Psi in the morning, I'll go over to the bistro for lunch and wander around my space-time with different velocities. But this would be at any instant, or for any small displacement along that trajectory, I'm moving with some certain velocity. And so these would be the relations that would still be true. So there's an assumption here that I can still use this standard or this formula, which should have had a c squared here, for this observer, he's just moving with a constant velocity. This observer is actually accelerating all over the place. And so the assumption is that these formulas aren't corrected, or that there's no extra terms due to, or that I don't have to correct for any acceleration effects. And we can take that as a fundamental assumption, but we also, or I can say that it's something that has been verified, at least implicitly, in experimental tests. For example, when one thinks about the motion or accelerating particles, those particles are typically or often accelerated in circular accelerators. So they're constantly accelerating. And yet, at any instant on the path in the accelerator, I can apply my standard formulas from special relativity. So if we're using the proper time, and I have some x alpha of tau, I can describe the tangent at any point here in terms of a 4 vector. This is the 4 velocity. So in the the same way that the classical, or in classical mechanics, we took the derivative with respect to time. Here we're just taking the derivative with respect to our proper time. And so if I actually do that, and I use these results over here, what I find is that the zeroth component, which is C dt d tau, is just equal to C over square root of 1, where gamma. Similarly, So this would be the, well, how I would follow or map out the trajectory in a covariant notation. I can still recover, though, the standard velocity just by looking at these formulas. What I can see is that if I take ui divided by u0, and I multiply by an extra factor of c, then what I recover is vi. But that's simply because what this is dxi d tau over dt d tau. And so this is just dx dt, the standard velocity, or the velocity that I would measure in it if I was sitting here in the fixed frame and watched the particle go by. The other thing that we can notice from our formula is I can take the inner product. So I recover V so the inner product with an eta alpha beta, U alpha, U beta is just equal, it's a fixed constant, it's minus C squared. And so this norm is just constant. And in fact, this is something that, irrespective of what frame I'm using to describe this world line, we're all going to agree on this fact right here. Now, four velocities are interesting. In general, though, when we're talking about physical processes, we're talking about things like momenta. And so the four velocity naturally gives us a four momentum in the same way essentially in an analog with what we had in classical mechanics. So our relativistic four momentum, we just take the four velocity and multiply by a constant, which is the rest mass of the particle. And all four of these components are going to be conserved. In interactions or in collisions, for instance. Again, that's something that's natural when in a moment when we realize that we're basically dealing with the standard momenta and energy, but it's also something that we experimentally verify. So if I look at the spatial components, pi, I have mvi times gamma. And if I think about a particle that's moving slowly, this is just the standard momentum plus small corrections. So course, if I look at P0, what I find is MC over the square root of 1 minus E squared over C squared. Following the notation that I had before, it's convenient to introduce a factor of 1 over C here, or we might just for the moment introduce that factor of 1 over C. Then what I have when I do this expansion is the leading term is just MC squared in the numerator. But then when I do the expansion, I pick up a term as well. And so what I see here is the standard kinetic energy. And then I've got this new relativistic term, which is sort of a potential energy or the rest mass energy that I associate with the particle. And so I can also then write this in the expected way. I can think of this as the relativistic energy divided by C. Remember, that's the formula we came up with when we were thinking about the photon's wave vector, or the four momentum that I wrote for the wave vector. And again, it has a fixed norm. So the norm is, again, just given by the rest mass. Now, although it's not very exciting in special relativity, what I'd like to do as a prelude to later calculations is write down a Lagrangian, or an action principle, for a particle moving through our Minkowski space-time. So in fact, I'm just thinking about a free particle in Minkowski space. In the book, you'll see a very elegant geometric action principle introduced. What I'm going to write down is a slightly different one. I'm going to write down an action principle that takes the following form. So I've introduced the rest mass. I've got a covariant or an invariant inner product here. And then I'm considering trajectories. Well, let's say I want to get from one space-time point to another. I'm going to just parameterize those trajectories in terms of some parameter lambda. So this is actually, or it looks very much like the Lagrangian that I would have written down in classical mechanics, except I would have had just dx's here, and this would have been the parameter I would have used is time. If I write my action, I've got an integral dl over some fixed interval of lambda. And if I take the variation delta x alpha, I end up with a very simple formula, d by d lambda of m eta alpha beta dx beta. Or alternatively, I can just write here that,
if you, let's say you reparameterize, you get a different action. You can change your action just by reparameterizing. Shouldn't it be the square root of that instead?
That's an interesting question, and what you said is correct. The square root gives us what we end up. Essentially, what we end up doing is we're extremizing a geometric property, the proper length of the object. One distinction here, though, is that if I just have an arbitrary lambda, then I'm not restricting this, the trajectories that I'm drawing here. The segments can be either time-like null, or time-like space-like, or null anywhere on that trajectory. If you write square root, then there's a you're looking at a slightly different action principle. There is actually a third action that you'll find in the homework assignment, which involves the reparameterization parameter. And what you'll see is that by making different choices, you can go from one action to the other action. So you're right, this action the reason I like this action is it's just very simple, it's very familiar to the classical action. The other action's a beautiful geometric one. The third action that I write down in the notes is actually one that takes advantage of or incorporates this idea of reparameterization along the path.
But I don't understand how this action can possibly work. Well, unless. So, naively, just looking at this, it seems like by making lambda larger or smaller, whatever, you can make the action arbitrarily small. So.
Well, no, I'm fixing.
Okay.
I'm fixing the interval, and so you can change the lambda in the middle.
But it'll fully test it.
But the variation has to go zero at the endpoint.
Yeah. Okay.
So you get a very simple result, namely the free particle follows straight lines in the Minkowski space. I can take the
norm of this four vector, and I'm going to end up with a constant, an invariant. So eta alpha beta dx alpha, actually the way I wrote it here, I had an m to be suggestive that the momentum was, or the conjugate momentum was being conserved. And what I'll find is that this is some constant. What I can do now, or what I can realize, is that this is a formula, essentially, that we saw just a moment ago in the contraction of the, if I was talking about a particle and its four momentum. And so what I can do is I can scale lambda to be the proper time, which fixes then, which is a choice for this constant to be minus m squared c squared. But again, in the general variations here, this makes sense assuming that the problem was set up that the trajectory is a time-like trajectory, but in the variational principle here, just thinking of this as an arbitrary parameter allows me to think about a more general set of variations than just the one, the time-like trajectories. And so, yeah, but we, it's, well, a standard normalization is then to fix lambda to be equal to tau. Well, in the book, there's a, well, there's a different action that's written down. And so, well, there's a different parameter, but it's also natural then that the trajectories are described in terms of just having constant four velocities. So again, this isn't very interesting free particle in Minkowski space, but this is essentially a tool that will be very useful when we're investigating more general spacetimes in the context of general relativity. And that's why we, well, I introduce or I remind you of that notation here. Are there any questions? Oh, there's a question in the back.
It seems to me that to choose this particular Lagrangian, we have to assume that the parameter is up to a scaling proportional to the proper time. Because if...
Yes, that's because of something happening in the fashion.
Sorry, say again?
I believe that to choose this particular Lagrangian, we have to pre-assume that the parameter lambda is proportional to the proper time. So it cannot be any arbitrary parameter.
Why am I assuming it's proportional?
Let's assume that lambda is proportional to tau squared. Then the argument is correct, so we'll get the same equation, and dx alpha to d lambda equals constant. So we'll get dx alpha to d tau equals constant tau, constant times tau.
You know, it would be simpler if you wrote it on the board. I apologize.
If the argument is independent of lambda, we'll end up with the same equation. Use the chain rule, I'll get the alpha equal to on alpha.
And I give two different values of tau giving the same.
What I mean is that we have to use the
square root
of the same action.
So I have to admit, I don't have, what do we do here? I mean, well, okay. If I set up, I guess the advantage that I saw in using this action here is that implicitly, well, at the end of the day, I talked about a math particle and one that follows a kind of like trajectory. But there's no real reason that you have to think about, you know, I can just drop that term and then I can think about any trajectory and just extremizing the path. It might be that boundary conditions are such that you produce a null trajectory if the points were null separated, or a space-like trajectory if the points were space-like separated. But your point has me confused as to I mean, I think all that's saying is that I can choose lambda to be another parameter,
tau squared. And we've called it tau squared, but it's not, you know, your parameter isn't going to satisfy this constraint here. So your tau isn't going to be the object that, or the parameter that we called the proper time before.
The thing that I know is that to write the actions in the general parameters will get a complicated notation, which if the barber, I guess, works on such problems. And in one of his talks, he presented the Lagrangian and said the parameter, the proper time parameter with the natural function, is the one that simplifies the Lagrangian. That's why I was told that the general parameter, lambda, cannot be the general parameter.
Maybe you're referring to the I can write an I can introduce as an auxiliary variable or a Lagrange multiplier that allows me to introduce arbitrary reparameterization in a natural way. Is that the action you're thinking of?
So one difficult problem I see is that you've decided to like contribute by setting lambda equal to the proper time squared. But so what the first thing we stipulated was that lambda it's a parameter with a constant range, so it goes from 0 to 1, for example, right? We're integrating over lambda from 0 to 1. So it's not, so like what if the proper time, you know? Because like given 2 points in space time, the proper time between like the proper time of a path will be like will sort of vary with the path, right? That's it. You can't do the proper time parameterization because if you as you vary the path, the proper time will vary, right?
Yep.
So but here to do this action, the parameter lambda has to always run from 0 to 1. So when you vary the path, you end up having to like rescale the proper time.
No, that's the problem. This isn't one that lambda here, but which goes from 0 to 1. If I take tau squared, I'll get some other path, which takes tau squared from 0 to 1.
Maybe you can tell me later about this action, because this is something I'm not familiar with, so I'm not exactly sure what I'm arguing against, but you can show me later on the web, or maybe there's a paper.
Sorry. I think the impact of lambda in the larger mean closure metric if you write the log lambda as this form, because the impact lambda data is a induced metric. You can change the spread rule from to this form data. But you should change the eta alpha lambda to a induced metric. So you differentiate with the lambda, you can just write this equation to that equation. Means d eta lambda beta d over d lambda is not equal to zero. You should have another term and plus m d x.
Oh, right. Okay. I think you're saying I should to make it properly invariant under reparameterization of the whatever the coordinate along the path, I have to introduce an auxiliary metric or an einbind in the action, and then the action takes a different form.
Yes, if you want to change the spread rule, the eta lambda beta can turn the lambda is a function of the lambda. Because eta lambda beta is a induced metric, not a mean coefficient metric. If you want to change the spread rule to this form.
Okay, I think we're agreeing. But again, what I would say is that, maybe it's something that we can discuss in the tutorial if people are interested, because there is a problem that discusses different variations on different action principles that I can write for a different world one, for different world one actions that I can use. I'm pretty sure I'm not following all of the indices that are being stated here, but I think that we're agreeing on the fact that I use an auxiliary metric for the world. So here's one of the main ones that come.
So I think to get a handle on this, it may be useful to look at the case of an elastic band, trying to minimize its energy. Because that we totally understand, and we know that we can parameterize the elastic band any way we want, right? And so you notice, for example, when you do it, I think at least, that you do get a square root. You end up, the action ends up getting a square root of, dx over dt squared plus dy over dt squared, where x and y are, the definition symbols of mass. And so in this case, right, you can immediately see you don't have the reparameterization problem up here because the action is in units of, 1 over t, where t is the parameterization.
Sure.
And so it gets integrated out. So that's, I think if we solve that problem, it will tell us how to solve this problem.
Okay. That's a good. Let's return to it over lunch. There is an exercise in the homework assignment, and maybe we can take a look at it and see if we're agreeing or not over lunch. The last set of ideas that
I wanted to introduce, though, very quickly was if I'm again thinking about an observer moving along some world line in the space-time, how does he measure physics, or how does he do physics? And so the idea is that the observer carries a clock and a set of rulers with him along the world line. And the illustrations in the book suggest, or the language suggests, that I should think that there's our observer is sitting in a very small laboratory that has an infinitesimal size along the world line, and in that laboratory he's making his measurements. He may be measuring the energy of some other particle that comes by, or a frequency, or a wavelength, or receiving signals of that sort. So,
so we're idealizing that this small lab is infinitesimal. And the mathematical idea, though, is that what we're going to have at each point is a set of unit vectors that define the basis for the rulers and the clocks, or for the experiments that he's carrying out in his lab. So
he carries four four orthonormal, actually unit vectors, along which he refers his measurements. His measurements of time and space, or spatial displacements. These are a set of four vectors. This four vector is, well, the zero implicitly says that it's a four vector that he uses to define his time measurements, or he uses to define how his clocks run. But if we recall, that's precisely, if you like, what the four velocity was doing. And so we can define the zeroth vector in this basis as being simply the four velocity. And because I said I wanted a unit vector, and I'm keeping my c around, I'm dividing by that c, so that e0 tilde dot e0 tilde is just equal to minus 1. So this says so that's a simple, that's the choice that one makes for the clock. The other vectors pointing in the spatial directions are more arbitrary, and we have more choices there. But basically, the defining relations are given in the words here. We want an orthogonal set of unit vectors. So EI dotted with EJ, where I and J now will run over those 1, 2, 3, are just going to be equal to delta IJ. Orthogonal also means that it should be, these vectors should be orthogonal to our time vector. And so there's also a restriction that EI dotted with E0 should be equal to 0. Yeah.
Just to be clear, so all we're really doing is we're saying if we set the origin, if we put the origin at our observer, like the observables that she cares around are just, you know, our unit vector is exclusive to their print, the rest of the
system. If you like, that's what we're saying.
Okay.
It's not.
I think it's not quite that, in that what you said is I'm putting the origin here. And so I'm not trying to define a coordinate system, in that I made a statement here that I have a vector, but I didn't say that I had, well, I could have said that I have a coordinate tau that runs, you know, from minus infinity to plus infinity along this line. But for the, as we'll see in a moment, for the measurements that I make, what's the only really important thing is that I know what these vectors are. I mean, I don't have to have a complete coordinate system that covers my entire space.
From our point of view, the observer has a velocity vector,
right,
our V4 vector. If we move their frame into our frame, that velocity vector becomes precisely V0, right? Their vector times vector, depending,
right? Right, so it's, yeah.
Okay.
But that'll happen only momentarily, right? If I mean, this guy is accelerating and moving around along a strange trajectory. If I'm an inertial observer, it might be that at this point, his core velocity and my E0 coincide, but then a moment later, his core velocity was gone.
Check, right? Because the core velocity is a function of time, so.
Yeah,
it's
right. Okay. I mean, it's certainly true that if I'm talking about an inertial or a straight line trajectory here, someone moving with a constant velocity, then when I choose the unit vectors here, I can, you know, these are just going to be standard unit vectors of Cartesian coordinates, and so I could set up a coordinate frame. I mean, this trajectory defines a certain frame of an inertial observer, but we'd like to get away from this kind of thinking and thinking. It'll be useful to think about more this in the context of a more general trajectory, maybe a general relativity. Chris.
How are these orthonormal vectors that he's carrying around? Are those norms then determined by, or do they determine the metric? I mean, is it an alternate way of talking about the metric, or?
I think you're anticipating something I'm going to write. I mean, so this is a four-vector, another four-vector. This is the, you know, the covariant or invariant inner product. So this is a fixed constant.
Right.
A fixed constant everywhere along.
It just seems suspiciously suspicious that those. Well, what you've written so far implies eta 8 alpha beta equals.
I think you want to say if I want to collect all four of those and introduce a dummy index, which I'll write as A, so that A runs over 0, 1, 2, 3 again, but those aren't the coordinate indices, these are indices distinguishing basis vectors.
Right.
Then when I take an inner product like this,
yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah. well, which is the next thing I was going to say as well.
Okay. Sorry.
But so this, yeah, this set of orthonormality relations that I wrote down here, because of that line of sign,
this looks or is identical to the metric that we've written down in our Minkowski spacetime. But again, these are different kinds of indices. When I write down an object like that, I'm recognizing that there's a set of basis vectors, and so this labels which vector, but it is a vector, and so it carries, well, implicitly as I've written it here, it carries another index, a space-time index. Which component? The vector. But as these are, so if I want to make measurements or I want to think about physics along this world line, these four vectors form a basis for any other vector, any four vector that I might want to measure or describe at that point. So any four vector along the world line can be expressed of these guys. So an example might be, here is a photon moving by here. It carries, or it has, a certain wave vector or momentum vector, four vector, and I can, when it crosses here, I can relate that four vector to the basis vectors that my observer has in his lab. And so I can write this as a linear combination of the basis vectors here. And so I'm re-expressing my instead of writing it in coordinate indices, or these with coordinate indices, I'm writing the components with these basis vectors indices. And again, there's an implicit sum . But what I said is that this is the basis that he uses, or that our observer uses, in making measurements. So these components are the components, or these numbers here are the components, or the values of the various components of the vector that passes through there. So So measurements are of these numbers, PA. Or alternatively, the projections of P onto the various components of A, or the various components of the basis vector. So for example, recall that we wrote a formula that a momentum four vector, the first component of it was the energy divided by C, And then the remaining components were the relativistic momenta. So these were the mv times gamma. And this was just m times gamma with various factors of c. But if I want to ask then, what is the energy that this guy or this observer assigns to this particle? Well, it's going to be the zeroth component in his basis, i.e. it's going to be that pa, but when a is equal to 0. So the observer measures an energy, which is C times P0, but that's just then minus C times so what I've done is I've picked out P0 here by taking the inner product with P with the basis vector E0, and then the orthogonality conditions are up here tell me that that gives me 0 for the spatial components, and it gives me a minus 1 for the zeroth component. And so that lets me write this formula right here. So let me so this is the projection or well maybe the arrow should be over here. It's the projection of our the momentum 4 vector on the time basis vector E0. Alternatively, I can remember this formula here, and I can just stick this in for E0, and then I get so the inner product of the momentum with the 4 velocity up to a minus sign gives me the energy that this particle or this observer associates with that 4 momentum. And again, this is well, if you like, it's trivial for observers who are following straight line trajectories. Those observers are just defining different inertial frames. But it's most useful when I'm thinking about, well, this is a useful formula in its own right. But it's also, these kinds of ideas are most useful when we're thinking about observers who are traveling along arbitrary time-like trajectories. In particular, this is a formula that will translate with minor modifications to general relativity, where we don't have these global inertial frames. And so it's a, again, it's an idea that'll be useful later on that we're introducing, well, the notation here in special relativity. I should pause. Are there any questions about the observers?
I just wanted to finish up by thinking about
an interesting example that's actually discussed in the book. But it's the example of an accelerating observer. And so we'll start with is consider the trajectory that's given by some t of lambda. Now, lambda is some arbitrary parameter. And so the first question is, what does that trajectory look like when I draw it in my space-time diagram? And so the answer is?
Are zero then, or?
For the purposes of,
Sorry.
No, that's a fair question. And we'll just set those to zero. This is just going to be motion in the, along the x-axis.
Things evolving in time, or the trajectory evolves in time, so I can put everything in the XT plane here. And the question was, what? Here's a picture. How do I draw the trajectory in that picture?
It's a hyperbola.
Okay, and how did you decide that?
Because it's the hyperbolic sine and cosine, and you're treating lambda as an angle there. So as it evolves, it's going to trace out.
So the trajectory is a hyperbola.
Yeah, and the y-axis is going to be your time axis because it's the sine and cosine.
So I can just write x squared minus t squared, and that gives me 1 on a squared times pi squared.
Minus inch squared. And so what I can do is draw a tangent here at 45 degrees. Oops, didn't quite. And so at asymptotes to x equals t, at asymptotes here to x equals minus t, and it crosses the x-axis at the value 1 over a. So, well, we can write this as x equals 1 over a at t equals 0. And that's at the value lambda equals 0. And so in general, I said this was an accelerating observer. The reason I can say it's an accelerating observer is he's not following a straight line. This line is bent, and so he must be accelerating in some way. So another question is, how does, or how is the parameter lambda related to the proper time along this trajectory?
Suggestion.
Proportion.
It is proportional. What's the proportionality? Well, there's only one parameter in the game. If any guess would be, it's either 1 over a or a.
And actually, you can
call
it.
Yeah.
It's a.
It's a. Okay. Or did Aaron want to contradict?
Oh, no, it was, I mean, I don't know if it's going to be, I just could say how to pump it.
Oh, okay, how do I pump it?
You just, so, you have, if you write down the equation, proper time after time alpha is, you know, you integrate the velocity vector, the length of the velocity vector from 0 to alpha. I mean, sorry, the alpha, we have lambda, so parameter alpha, not bad. And then you just differentiate tau with respect to lambda, and that should give you, you know, you'll end up with, yeah, I didn't actually work it out yet, but.
I think, well, let me ask, tell me if this is what you're thinking. So I know that the tau squared is given by the t squared minus the x squared. That's That's our definition of what a proper time is. Or, well, I've dropped a C. Well, I'm going to drop a C in these calculations. And so if I ask what is dg, well, here's the formula. So if it's just 1 over a times the derivative of this inch is the cosine, or cosh, lambda squared minus 1 over a, the derivative here is a inch, lambda d lambda squared. Again, what I end up with is cosh squared minus h squared. And so what I've got is 1 over a squared d lambda squared. And so what I know is that d tau is equal to actually plus or minus 1 over a d lambda. I know that in the way I've written it, that as lambda increases, I'm moving forward or I'm moving up in the diagram. I'd like the same to be true for at any moment here, tau should be evolving or increasing towards the future. And so we'll choose the plus sign. We'll just write that. And now what I can do is I can simply integrate and I get the proportionality that lambda is equal to a tau plus some constant, we'll throw that away. So lambda is just equal to a tau. That's the simplest choice we can make. And so if I just plug that in over there, then my trajectory that I'm thinking about is 1 on a cinch, a tau, and 1 on a cosh, a tau. Given the parameterized trajectory now in terms of the proper time, the natural question to ask is, well, what's the orbitality vector?
Sorry. Yeah. I just wondered, why is this the trajectory of an accelerating observer?
Well, I haven't told you what kind of acceleration he's experiencing, but what I told you at this point was just, this is a Minkowski space diagram. This trajectory is bent. It's not following a straight line. And so that means that this isn't an inertial observer or inertial trajectory. And so that means it must be accelerating in some way.
Okay. So could I ask what kind of acceleration?
We could. But first, I want to calculate the core velocity. So tell me what the core velocity is, and I'll tell you what the acceleration is.
And the core velocity is the inner product of two velocities, or the velocity itself. And we are given the velocity, right? It's just the.
Sorry.
So the velocity will just be the space time position over the parameter.
Right.
So.
So here we have our trajectory. We've rewritten in terms of proper time. U alpha is just
dx alpha, d tau. And so I take those derivatives. Again, I'm being lazy. I'm not introducing c's. If I take the derivative here, I just get a cosh, a tau. If I take the derivative there, I get the sinh, a tau. And just for completeness, if I'm thinking about four-dimensional Minkowski space, there's a couple of zeros there. One of the things we might ask is what is, so this is a four velocity and these are the components. One of the things we might ask is what is the actual physical velocity or the velocity if I'm an observer, an inertial observer sitting here, what's the velocity I measure that person or this particle going by at? And so the three velocity well, we'll just stick to x. the three velocity is zero in the y and the z directions, obviously. But what I had said is that this is just ui or ux over u0, or alternatively, it's u, what is it? It's dx d tau over dt d tau. And so if I just plug in this, what I find is a cinch over a cosh or a hyperbolic tangent. And so what are some of the interesting points that one can see there? Well, one can see that the velocity is zero at tau equals zero. So that's in keeping with the tangent here to the hyperbola as it crosses the line is actually a vertical. And so it's not moving in the x direction at all. Alternatively, we can also think what happens when tau goes to plus or minus infinity. And what we might remember is that the hyperbolic tangent actually goes to plus 1 at plus infinity and minus 1 at minus infinity. And so that's reflecting the fact that here, if I follow it forward to plus infinity, the hyperbola approximately approaches this tangent at 45 degrees, which is a null line. And so it's approximately becoming null, or the particle is approximately approaching the speed of light. And similarly, in the past, it's approaching the other tangent, x equals minus t.
It's not clear to me where you what parameter you have to change for the velocities asymptotically approaching.
Well, we're about to see that the disk trajectory accelerates in a very special way. But you're saying here that I can start at say minus b to a plus b.
Well, how would you represent a trajectory like that, I guess?
Right. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that was the question. So a simple way to do that is to stick a beacon there.
Okay.
So where would that be come? Well, you could get that be from sticking
it in. Oh, by using a different constant in front of the... Got it.
Yeah, I'm not doing anything profound because all we're doing, we're not saying that this came from anything special.
Yeah.
We're just drawing pictures. So that's a simple way to get the answer that you want. I mean, of course, we could draw much more elaborate.
Well, if it's kind of dumb, I just got a little lost in the.
So we, of course, know that there's a natural procedure for somebody to follow the hyperbolic trajectory to approach the speed of light. Is there also a natural procedure for, like, somebody...
There's a natural procedure...
If you want to get into one of these trajectories, if I want to get into this trajectory relative to you, all I do is get the spaceship into the gas and just hold the gas double down, right? And I probably travel along this trajectory. If I want to travel along Chris's trajectory approaching constant speed, not the speed of light relative to you, is there a similar, like... simple procedure I could do?
Well, you could get in the spaceship and vary your pressure on the gas pedal.
I'd have to vary it in like a weird way.
It would be a different
way. I'd have to keep track of the plane. Yeah.
So we've been hinting at acceleration, the fact that there is an acceleration, and apparently some of you may have seen this before. So an acceleration is going to be a second derivative. It's natural to build a four acceleration. which I would define to be the second derivative or the first derivative of u. This is something that naturally appears in, so as an aside, it naturally appears in a relativistic version of the second law.
Which he writes as m du d tau, so this is the ma part, and then on the other side, there's just a definition of a force four vector. So this is the vector or the force that we're going to have to apply to produce the appropriate acceleration. This naturally, an equation like that looks very much like the first equation I wrote on the board, and so it naturally reduces in a non-relativistic limit to our standard F equals ma. It also, in the absence of any forces, it gives us the equation du d tau equals zero, which was our equation to describe just a simple straight trajectory. The four velocity wasn't changing. And it has a relative, well, I'm using a relativistic notation. So I can treat these all as four vector, or these two as four vectors. This is just, the mass is just a constant. And so I would be able to write that in the same form in any inertial frame. In the present case, then, we had a four velocity here. I'm told that to get the components of our four acceleration, I'm just going to take an extra derivative. And so if I take the tau derivative here, I get a cinch, and I bring out a factor of this a. And similarly, I get a cosh a tau, and then I fill out my vector with the zeros. Well, the thing then, or a distinguishing feature of this particular trajectory, or the trajectory that we chose at the beginning, comes when I look at the inner product, or the norm of this four velocity vector, or four acceleration vector, in that what I find again is a combination of cosh squared minus cinch squared. Now there's an extra factor of a. And so I get a plus a squared. So for this particular trajectory that we've drawn on the board, the four acceleration has a constant norm. And hence the comment, or implicitly, that when I get in my rocket ship, I apply a constant force, and I'll produce a trajectory that looks very similar to this. Or if I start at rest, I would get the top half of my trajectory. Before we leave the four acceleration, I'll just make, again, an aside. These are comments that don't apply just to the special case, but are quite general. That is that what we found was that the four velocity was something that had a, well, it was engineered. It had a fixed norm to be, it was minus c squared. Now it's minus 1 when we drop the factors of c. So if I take a tau derivative of that equation, I get a zero over here, but on the other side of the equation, well, I'll get two terms, but they both have the same form. There's a U inner product with the four acceleration. And so what that's saying in our Minkowski space measure, the acceleration four vector and the velocity four vector with these definitions are always orthogonal. So that's a again, a general result. But what we can do, if I hadn't erased the four velocity, is we could easily check that that's the case for us. So if we look at U dot A, well, what I have in the time component here, there's a cinch tau, The four velocity, the time component was cosh A tau. Then there's a plus, the spatial component here was a cinch A tau. And then now here I have an A cosh tau. So again, this is a specific example, but we realize this general result that that inner product vanishes. We had talked about,
So since this is the natural way to talk about forces in special relativity, so the in electromagnetism, the Lorentz force, would you just replace F by the Lorentz force, or would you add some kind of gammas or something to it?
I'm not sure what just replace that by the Lorentz force would mean. There is a natural four vector that you could write there, which would be something like, well, we talked about this object, right? Mm-hmm. And that's got two indices, but there's another vector around, so we could write that. And if we think about that, well, what do I have? You know, this, or to get a, I mean, you're invited to think about this again in one of the problems, but if I think about this, this is something that had velocities in it. This had something with electric and magnetic fields. So you can see that some of the components here are going to be like B cross B terms, or you might imagine that they are.
And I guess there must be a gamma because U has gamma in it, right? Gamma times C, B.
Well, the bottom line is I'm not going to write an equation with an extra gamma.
Right, not an extra. Okay.
There are going to be gammas hidden in this equation already. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So that when you write like the Lorentz force, it would like just a
it would transform part. Like a four. So
you get gamma.
Yeah, you get a gamma, yeah. Right?
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, oh, I've got 15. The other idea, or another idea that we talked about was orthonormal bases. So what's a natural basis, or what would be the natural basis for an observer who was following this trajectory? So, suggestions. What would I choose, or how would I start to construct this basis for my observer? Aaron.
Take the basis, you start off in the rest frame where you are, and then you translate over to where your observer is at a certain lambda. And then
I could do that, yes. But I will choose, but I will suggest that there's a simpler way to think about it. Are there any other suggestions? So our recipe was that the zero component was?
The time. Or sorry, tangent to the.
It was a tangent to the curve or what we call the formula. So the simplest way to start is just to write that down. That was something that we already calculated. I will tell you two other trivial ones. There's for the y and z direction, there'll be what we'll call t2. Or we'll just have constant vectors. Well, the simplest choice is to have constant vectors. Let's take out along the y and z axes. And so the remaining question is, what about our x?
Acceleration.
Sorry?
Acceleration. For it.
Yes.
Time out of a, okay. So why is the acceleration a proper choice or an interesting choice?
It's orthogonal to e0.
Sorry?
It's orthogonal to e0, which you put right there.
And yeah.
It's also orthogonal to e2 and e3, so any other vector will be a proportional acceleration.
That's certainly true. But there was one other property that I want. I want it to have a unit norm, and that's a fix. I want it to be at length 1.
Yeah, the magnitude is constant, so you can just.
So in this very special case, what we showed, well, what was just erased down here, was the acceleration also had a fixed magnitude. And so if I normalize it by a factor of a, I'll get
an appropriate unit vector. So this is the answer that was suggested. And again, the reason that this works is that E1 dot E0 is 0. And that came because the 4 acceleration and the 4 velocity were orthogonal. It's also orthogonal to these two. But it's also true that for the very special trajectory that we're considering, A had a fixed norm. And so it also satisfies this condition here, or I've fixed it up so that it satisfies that condition there. And just for completeness, that was sinh a tau, cosh a tau, 0, 0. So now we have a basis, set of basis vectors, so we can make a measurement. So what's the measurement that I suggest we make? So what I'm going to say is imagine there's a source of photons sitting at the origin. So sitting at the x-axis, its world line then is just running up along x equals 0 or along the CT axis in our Minkowski space. And this source constantly emits with an angular frequency omega star. So as he moves along the trajectory, our observer can be receiving these photons. And then the question is, what frequency does he observe? And so again, the question is, or the floor is open to suggestions.
T equals zero or just
one? No, what I'm imagining is, so here's my observer doing, well, not quite that trajectory, but I have
a source, well, he follows, the source follows this world line, and it's constantly emitting photons. So this guy is constantly receiving photons, but the frequency that he measures changes as he moves along the trajectory. Yeah. Can I look at the period? I could, but I suggested, or there's a much simpler recipe. It's a formula that I wrote on the board not long ago on how I use the basis vectors to relate general four vectors to measurements that an observer makes.
Just project the four moment of the four particles in the E0.
Right.
Oh.
So, inside what?
The frequency is dependent. We project the momentum on into the basis of the accelerating observer because the momentum is dependent on the angular frequency.
Right, but well, the suggestion here was to label it with the four vector, but a factor h bar takes us to the planet. So it's the same suggestion. No, that's what we want. So if these photons
have some four momentum, then our recipe was that. Well, that the four momentum dotted into the zeroth basis vector over here was going to give us the frequency that our observer measures. And if you look at the formulas, there's actually a minus sign in there. And there are also factors of C, but we're dropping all our factors of C in this example. Or alternatively, since this guy was just the four velocity, I had also written an equation very much like that saying k dot u. And again, it's because the frequency is just the zeroth component of our four vector there, the four wave vector. So there's the nice formula. That's the formula I want to use. I see U written on the board there. What's the K that I want to use to stick into this formula?
C over omega.
Sorry, what do you want here, right?
Omega is the first component, and C over omega is the second.
Like that?
So.
Let's have a vote. Who likes this suggestion? Okay. Who thinks there's something wrong with this suggestion? Or it's not quite right. It has to be revised. You can't get on stage. What revision would you like to make?
Just omega omega.
Right. So one of the things we know is, or one of the things that we said earlier was that the vector should be a null vector. And so there's a k, or there's a spatial kx here, but in order to make it a null vector, it should just be omega, then the norm of k is equal to zero. Actually, I called it omega star, so we'll pick an omega star.
But why wouldn't you think that we could put C over omega?
A minor lapse. I'm not sure. It was a minor lapse.
Yep.
Okay, so now we have a four wave vector, we've got a four velocity, and so we can calculate a frequency. And we're all wanting to go to lunch, so I'll just do it for you. So omega, did I give it a name? Omega observed minus theta, there's a minus sign. Then there's a minus sign in our Minkowski metric. There's an omega star.
There, there's a cosh, a tau for the time component. Then there's a plus sign, there's another omega star, and there's a sinh, a tau. And so what we find is that there's an omega star times a cosh, a tau, minus a sinh, a tau. And if we remember our formulas or our definitions of cosh and sinh, what we find is that gets very neatly packaged as an exponential minus a tau. So if I look at that formula, what do I see? Well, at tau equals zero, what we had said was the observer was momentarily at rest in this inertial frame. And so what we see here is that omega naught equals omega star at that moment because there's no relative velocity. On the other hand, if I go, say, to tau equals plus infinity, now I'm traveling, or the observer is almost traveling or approaching the speed of light. And what we see is that the redshift goes to infinity. The frequency that I'm observing gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So omega naught goes to zero as tau goes to infinity. On the other hand, we can also think about going to minus infinity. At that point, what we have is that the observer's moving at almost the speed of light towards the source. And so what we get is an infinite, or a nearly infinite, blue shift. What we find is that this frequency is actually going to plus infinity in the infinite path. Which may have rather tragic consequences, but we won't ponder on that. And I think that's a good time to take a break, or actually quit for the day, unless there are any questions.
If not, I will lunch your drinks. Okay,
well, we've got one then, I guess.
Okay.
Does anybody want
to print off the tutorial questions are already on the web on the wiki? Who doesn't want to print it off? Since I have a rough idea of it. Okay, I'll do 28 copies.
The idea is that you're supposed to hold on a laptop.